Now I reckon some of you boys be dying from the super plague.
No, only 3,000 people have died. The super plague is well under control.
That ain't what I hear. I hear folks are dropping dead. I hear Captain Trips has made the rounds.
Yes, 3,000, not 300 million.
You know, son, country don't mean dumb.
I didn't say that you were dumb. I'm saying to you that everything is more or less all right. You can have a super plague without everybody dying.
This is your last chance. I'm here to help you, son.
Actually, it's our last chance.
Okay, so I am here with Fiona Muzzle, who is the author of Last Chance. Fiona, how are you doing?
I'm great, thanks.
You're looking around. I suspect we are under observation.
We are indeed.
Who are these individuals?
To my left is the lovely and charming Gina Zucker and Nellie Reifler.
Okay, and now listeners on this podcast will know who they are.
Indeed. Well, I hope so. They should.
Yeah. So let's talk about this book. Some chickens fly the coop, but in your case, you have Lucy flying from a kosher chicken factory back to her own coop. So we immediately understand this is a person who, well, does the very opposite of what is expected. And I wanted to ask you about this, if this book can be read as a series of narrative inversions, the slaughter of kosher chickens, how did this lead to the super plague element? And I'm also curious if this was a matter of considering the... What the hell? Was it a matter of, here's what I wrote. Was it a matter of considering the unwholesomeness within non-kosher chickens? So I suspect that what I intended here was to kind of ask you about the process of narrative inversion. Go ahead. Let's try to answer this convoluted question.
I'm going to try. I guess my answer would be twofold. One, I want to say that all of the decisions I made for the book have this kind of... aesthetic and really well thought out pedigree, but in fact they don't. A lot of what I ended up doing happens by accident and haphazardly. I had certain interests that I wanted to pursue, and once I started pursuing them, I had to decide whether I could justify the pursuit or if I just had to, you know, abandon ship. Uh-huh. It's true that a lot of what happens in the novel is sort of counterintuitive, but it depends who you're asking.
Yeah.
You know, the book is full of crazies. They're drug addicts. They're people who are hurting. They're desperate. They're nuts. And so for them, what they're doing doesn't seem counterintuitive at all. The fact that this incredibly rich, waspy girl would end up slaughtering chickens at a kosher chicken plant in upstate New York really doesn't seem all that crazy to her.
Yeah.
Because from her vantage, why not? You know, why wouldn't she end up having this completely demoralizing and dismantling life given her sense of self and what she thinks her prospects are for success? As for the kosher chickens themselves, well... You know, a few years ago I had seen a promotional video for Empire Kosher Chicken, which was essentially this hapless rabbi running around a bunch of supermarkets, accosting people with his little lo-fi handheld camera and asking them if they knew what it meant, what kosher meant. And it just seemed so risible and maudlin and dreadful that I thought, you know, I really want to write about this. Because those things turn out to be... really important criteria when it comes time for me to decide what do I want to write about. If it's risible and maudlin and dreadful, chances are I'm going to take an interest.
But back to this issue of inversions, I agree with you. This is essentially up to the individual. But if we look at it from a societal standpoint, well, that's a whole different ball of wax here. And I'm wondering if you had this in mind when creating these particular ironies or these antipodean justifications of how characters act, or whether this was largely intuitive. I mean, that's, of course, the age-old question of a novelist.
I'm going to go with the latter, because I did have some big ideas for the book, but I hadn't intended to sort of create this inverted landscape where people are doing the opposite of what is expected of them. I think they kind of behave maybe in a way that keeps with what is expected of people who are suffering. The plots themselves might be a little absurdist. The context is absurdist, but the emotions that people are sustaining and enduring seem at least maybe remotely pertinent to the human experiences I'd like to imagine most people have it.
Yeah. Well, a fair enough answer, but I should point out that we don't actually learn the name of the protagonist until about 75 pages into the book, where we finally learn, her name is Lucy. And this is interesting to me because here she is grappling with her own identity, trying to escape her own sense of self, and yet as her sense of the world unfolds throughout the course of this narrative, the number of Lucys that are referenced by herself and by others gradually begins to expand. I don't think it's entirely related to the rehab center, but I wanted to ask you about something like this because that is, I think, not something that is intuitive.
Well, I mean, I think when you want to think about the craft of trying to write a first-person narrator isn't going to be announcing herself. It's just not what she would do. She doesn't have a really good sense of self.
Yeah.
It's not something I would expect her to do. You actually do find out who she is a little bit earlier, I guess, but it's kind of does happen in passing. But, you know, everyone in the book is someone else. Everyone is someone else reincarnated. So there's a lot of identity crises happening throughout, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I also wanted to ask you about, I observed some interesting parallels between your book and Mary Shelley's The Last Man, because both concerned themselves with family. And, of course, The Last Man is the ultimate plague novel exemplar.
I haven't read it.
You haven't? Okay, well then that's so much for that question, because that's written in the first person, and that it also ends at In the Coast. I don't want to reveal the ending to your book, but it was very interesting to me. I had wondered if you had been drawn to Shelley for inspiration.
I actually quite made a real point of not reading any of the plague books. I'd never read Camus until after I finished the novel. You know, Defoe wrote, I think it was called Journal of a Year, Plague Year of 1670-something. And there's a Kazan movie, I think, that's pretty well-known, Panic in the Streets.
Yeah.
I made a real point of not seeing any of this stuff. I mean, I did have anxiety of influence. I didn't want to find out that what I was doing was a bromide and that the ground had been so heavily trodden. And I was afraid that I would just be extraordinarily intimidated and oppressed by my forebears in this regard. So I really actually wasn't looking for inspiration from these people. I didn't want to know.
Interesting. But, I mean, if you look at, say, more lower-brow choices like Stephen King's The Stand or The Andromeda Strain or any number of super plague television series like The Survivors and things like that, one tends to find a narrative that begins with the decimation of humanity. Yours is not that particular book. Well, again, going to this question of inversions, I'm wondering if you made a particular choice. You had to have known about The Strand.
It's true. But I didn't think it was an inversion. I thought it was credible, actually, that I did a lot of research about plague and also just about the CDC and how likely, and bioterrorism, and just how likely the scenario I proposed is. It's extraordinarily likely. It's not, this isn't an alternate reality kind of novel. It didn't seem likely that someone would unleash a plague and actually wipe out all of humanity. That's just not credible. I wanted to come up with a credible scenario. So I guess from a kind of from the perspective of someone writing fiction or reading fiction, one might expect something like a terrific slate wiper to come along, as we've seen in so many of these movies and books. But I actually wanted something that seemed really realistic, that only 3,000 people would die, that in fact they'd put a stop to it. That when we, for instance, when we had this little anthrax outbreak or even bird flu, people are dying, but they're still containing it. I was more interested in the anxiety, the terror, of the foreboding of what could happen. Might this thing actually wipe out, you know, 100 million Americans or 100 million, you know, people? That was more interesting to me than actually watching this disease, you know, tramp across the country and actually kill off, you know, half the United States.
If you were unaware of contemporary novels or remained deliberately, you set out to write this with your blinders on, well, you had to have been at least remotely aware of the many dystopian novels that have come down the pipeline in the last couple of years. Was this one of the key inspirations as to why you decided upon the super plague? The sense I got was that you probably decided upon the kosher chickens before you decided upon the super plague, and I don't think I really got an answer to that question of how that came from the chickens.
I just don't know that they're actually all that related, really. I mean, what happened was I knew I wanted to write about disease. I was reading John Kelly's terrific book about the bubonic plague, and I was reading about, you know, these guys vaulting these dead plague bodies over the walls into these fortified communities, and it was kind of the first act of bioterrorism. I thought this was just grim and dreadful, and again, like I said, I thought, I want to write about this.
But also quite funny, I think.
It was.
It's so absurd that people would actually do this, and yet it's also terrible at the same time.
It's precisely that kind of black humor that I, you know, caught into.
I'm wondering if the humorous tone of this came about because, well, here you are presented with these just really terrible acts of humanity. The only real way to absorb them so to speak, is to really look at them through a comical prism.
That's kind of absolutely right. These things are so unrelentingly and unflaggingly depressing.
Yeah.
I don't think there's any way to package them with anything but a certain degree of humor. Because otherwise you can't look at them hard, you know, for very long.
Was this originally intended as a more serious book, or?
No.
Oh, okay.
Absolutely not.
Okay.
It always started off as being this kind of farce. And in fact, I really had to pull away from the farcical elements of the book because I think if you are sort of consistently droll and you always adopt that kind of humorous affect, you become unreachable in a way. You become impenetrable.
I don't know.
I think as a character, one can become, a character like Lucy might become unreachable and impenetrable. And I wanted to soften her up a little bit. I wanted her to be a character that you could reach if you stuck with her for long enough, which meant having to tamp down the humor a little bit. I do want to answer your earlier question, though. So I knew that I wanted to write about disease, and I knew that I wanted to start the book at this kosher chicken plant. And when I started to do a lot of research, I began to see, for instance, that chickens were very useful in the detection of West Nile virus. And so I started to make connections. You know, I started to see that it wasn't just disease I wanted to write about. I mean, I could have written about influenza, but I wanted a disease that had a particular kind of historical presence, something that kept coming back, because I began to see that I wanted to talk about recycling and reincarnation, and all these things began to fit together. So I started to piece them together kind of at the same time.
Well, going into this idea of perspective, I mean, it almost seems to me that the tone was dictated by the voice. Did you lay down any particular ground rules as to how far Lucy would go, or how serious, or how ridiculous, or whatnot? The level of force that you would actually explore through her voice?
Yeah, I mean, I wanted her to be able to move through multiple registers, for sure. I wanted her to be able to kind of get mileage out of refracting, you know, her experience of the world through that kind of sardonic attitude that she has. But I also wanted her to be able to expose herself and make herself vulnerable in a way that seemed really not so much funny as just moving. I certainly attempted to be moving, but I'm very impulsive, and frequently I will just be absurd for the sake of absurdity. And as it turned out, there are a lot of reincarnated voices in the book, and they were a real outlet for me because it gave me an opportunity to be a little bit crazy and to do something that seemed really oddball to me. I hoped that thematically I could justify it. I was certainly trying to,
yeah.
But they were a great outlet for me to just do the weird things that I like to do in fiction without compromising the rest of the story. So I managed to keep the story as less absurd than it might have been because
yeah.
I had this this venue, basically, for my kind of absurdist inclination. So
I'm wondering if the voices came about because, well, one can only write about a drug addict before being mired in melancholy. I mean, were they sort of an escape for you to get away from this just absolutely oppressive, depressive? Or
a little bit, but really more it was just a chance to really have fun, to just go hog wild. I mean, I got to write in the voice of a 9th century Viking,
yeah.
in the voice of a 14th century flagellant. I got to write in the voice of a child, of a retarded child, and a woman who's sort of drowning in a mine in the Gulf of Finland. I really got to have fun and to play around. And for me, that's very important,
to get
that opportunity.
Yeah, sorry. I'm also wondering if these voices came about because you wanted to explore essentially a historical cycle of plagues, or whether one voice, say, the 9th century Viking, came about as a sort of, oh, where the hell was this? Well, I better tie it in together to the main framework. Was that the scenario, or was this all planned from the beginning? I mean, it sounds to me like in exploring the history of disease, you then create a novel that becomes a mammoth investigation, so to speak.
That's kind of right. I mean, it's a little bit of both. It's a little bit of pawing around in the dark, finding something I can latch onto, and then making use of it. I knew that I wanted the book to be about reincarnation. I certainly had it intended from the get-go that that everyone in this family was going to be someone else reincarnated. I hadn't planned that, and I hadn't planned that they would all talk. But when it came time to try to figure out who all these people were going to be, it seemed logical that the mother would be this 9th century Viking, because it's really the grandmother who has this idea. So what would she think of her crazy crackhead daughter? You know, they're Norwegians. What would she think? Well, she might think her daughter's a Viking. So I began to research the Vikings. Instantly, I found out that they were in the, I guess it was the plague of Justinian in the 6th century. There was a lot of plague happening there. And, of course, the Vikings were very big into the oral tradition, and the Norse sagas are all about the supremacy of the word. And, of course, a lot of the novel is about narcotics recovery, and one of the cornerstones of narcotics recovery is, it seems to me, the oral tradition, passing on your story. You know, I tell you my story, you tell me your story, we help each other stay alive. So all of these elements began to dovetail. I thought, well, so I can have this Viking speak about language and about poetry and about storytelling. And if I give voice to him, then it gives me an opportunity to start giving voice to everyone else. And when I began to do that, I started to choose people that made sense within the context of the book, the themes and whatnot. I mean, I didn't choose a 14th century flagellant by accident. It's because flagellation was a big part of the 14th century's community's response to the bubonic plague.
Yeah. But if these historical figures are reincarnation, that also assumes that the reader is buying that particular literal reincarnation, because this could also be in the perspective of Lucy's head. She's trying to make sense of her grandmother's reincarnation practices, and possibly this is her way of figuring out where she is situated in the world. Was anything along these lines intended, or was this really a more of a matter of fun, of multiple voices?
No, it's certainly open-ended. I mean, it's up to the reader to decide whether the book is actually endorsing reincarnation as a kind of legitimate phenomenon. Or whether it's just Lucy sort of projecting onto her family, or even the grandmother projecting onto the family, you know, these alternate lives by way of explaining, you know, why is this 12-year-old girl cutting herself? Why is she so guilty? It's because she's a flagellant, you know, reincarnated flagellant. But it was also kind of a way of articulating, again, one of these principles of narcotics recovery, that you keep coming back. Yeah. You keep coming back. You keep trying to get it right. It's Groundhog Day. Groundhog Day is the essence of recovery and reincarnation. Those principles map quite nicely.
I understand that reincarnation is an issue on Obama's platform. Do you endorse reincarnation? Or?
I do not believe in it, no.
Okay. But can one endorse it or believe in it? Or what's the distinction here? What's the verb to be used?
Well, the book, you know, the book might well endorse it. I think the book does. I think the book makes a claim that, like, reincarnation exists. I personally don't actually believe that I'm coming back. It's not what I think. But I think it's such an elegant idea. Just this idea that we keep coming back, and that each time we come back, we're a little bit higher on this ladder. We've learned a little bit more.
Yeah. I mean, it's, again, going back to the idea whether it's reincarnation or historical cycles, I should point out that Lucy has some very intriguing sartorial choices. The dog collar around her neck from her mother's mastiff, also the thongs at one point. I was reading this saying, there's an interesting elliptical theme going on here, and so I'm led to believe that if everything is about her body and her abusiveness and her trying to make sense of herself in relation to the world, that this is intended to suggest that, well, this juxtaposition of the plague is in an endless plague that goes on and on and on. Is there a risk in reading too much into, say, a thong?
Well, it's interesting you bring that up, actually, because there is a point in the novel where she's sitting, Lucy is sitting with a dead man on the floor at the rehab, and she has this little paragraph where she starts talking about she and this dead guy's different approaches to their bodies, that she is very much engaged in destroying her body, and it seems like perhaps this is a kind of a path towards enlightenment, that the body is of no significance, because if you believe in reincarnation, what is your body? On the other hand, if you try to privilege the body and really take care of it, you might actually be someone who believes in resurrection, which is all about, you know, the body. So that is certainly a real part of it, a part of the novel, particularly since I got very graphic about the plague and how the plague what it would actually do to your body. I tried to get really gritty and kind of unpleasantly graphic about, well, not just plague, but about smallpox, because I was really interested in the kind of visceral meltdown that happens as a result of contracting a plague. It's not quite what you're asking, but it is a kind of a big part of the book. I hadn't there are not many physical descriptions in the book, you'll notice, about what people look like now and then. You know, they come in passing, so that whenever I did try to focus on the body, it was for those reasons.
Well, I mentioned a descriptive choice like this because the thing about the prose in this book that struck me was the fact that, well, it reads very fast, but if you read it too fast, you will lose these little minuscule details, and this is particularly evident in the anarchy of the first 100 pages or so.
Right.
So, you know, this is why I ask over these conscious decisions, or whether these are intuitive, or whether these are conscious, or whether this is entirely just instinct that we're talking about.
I'd say it was both. Some things I paid more attention to than others, for sure. Thematically, like I said, I got very... almost every word has a reason when it comes to the narcotics recovery and the reincarnation and, you know, people's responses to plague, and there's a lot of ideology and there's a lot of kind of social criticism. But then a lot of it is also just craziness.
Yeah.
And it's, I guess as a reader, it's a little bit hard to know which is which.
I must ask you about Quinty, because I was thinking Claire Quilty. Was this kind of your little ode to Nabokov?
Nope, not at all.
Okay.
Not at all.
Where did the name Quinty come from?
I don't know. I liked it. You know, it's funny. I've noticed a couple reviewers have said with a certain kind of, to me, sort of comic certainty. They have a certain certainty about, you know, what my intentions must have been. And I'm always just so startled by these things. I think, really? And never once, you know, might this have crossed my mind. Someone said that was quite clearly, the book was quite clearly an homage to Vonnegut. And I must be obsessed with Vonnegut. Honestly, until a month ago, I had never, ever read a single book he'd ever written. I just never, you know...
Well, let's set the record straight. What were your intentions, Fiona? Describe every single one of them right now.
I wanted to write a good book.
Okay.
That was my goal. I wanted... You know, I think that a great book, you know, a book is great if it's accomplished a few things. Among them... you know, that it is solacing and instructive and dismantling and moving and all of those things. And I was certainly aiming high. I was shooting for those things. If I managed even to do one of them, you know, I'm happy.
I wanted to ask you why you chose Texas as the location for the rehab center. I mean, one could suggest that this reflects the Lone Star State's independent mentality. Or was there a specific reason, or did you just feel that you were deep in the heart of Texas?
Well... I wanted the book to range across the country. I had set part of it in Pennsylvania and part of it was in New York and there was a little bit in California. So I wanted to move around because I wanted you to feel like this was a national situation that we were in. These were drug addicts and they had very private, localized problems, but that this pandemic of the plague was national and the business of suffering from addiction was a kind of a national pandemic itself. It's an international pandemic, but never mind.
Yeah.
So that was one thing. So I wanted to choose a place that was different, just quite distinct from where the rest of the book was set. The other thing is that I wanted a kind of a vast wasteland kind of place. I wanted a desert. I wanted there to be nothing there, in large part because it made sense, because rehabs typically are in the middle of nowhere.
You wanted to be T.S. Eliot.
I did. And I wanted also this, I wanted people to be running around the desert trying to escape the plague. It just struck me as absurd and horrible. The other thing was that I happened to be in Texas.
Yeah.
While I was working on this, I could have easily set it in Arizona or, you know, Southern California or, you know, some part of the desert, Northern California. So it didn't have to be Texas. But I did also want to choose a place that I thought would be not so upscale, that would attract... A lot of the voices of the women who are there, they're not rich, they're not privileged, they're not famous actresses, you know, the people you tend to think about going to rehab, they're just normal people who are really in trouble.
You need the juxtaposition then of, I suppose, the common wheel compared to Lucy, who has this privileged background.
Sure.
You were looking for expanse, you were looking, I suppose, for comparative dichotomies? Or?
In a way, yeah. And I wanted to be able to find a place where you would find some of these characters that I've come up with, this... You know, woman with the trach tube, and you know, other women is the meth head who's a truck driver.
Yeah.
You know, where would these people end up going? They're not going to go to Silver Lake. You know, they're not going to end up going to these fancy rehabs in California or you know, Florida, Connecticut. So I really wanted to choose someplace that was just going to be about normal people, because I wasn't going to glorify, you know, these addicts. I really just wanted to find women who are really just suffering, and to put this crazy character, this protagonist, and her extremely wealthy mother, who are quite outlandish and and full of hyperbole and stick them among these women who are just kind of normal women.
Why have Lucy come from a place of wealth as opposed to a place of grit? If you were after the grit, well, would you, again, going back to the initial trajectory of this conversation about inversion,
I wasn't just after the grit.
Yeah.
I was looking for the grit in contrast, in the way that I was kind of interested in looking at, say, the selfishness, the terrible selfishness of addiction, and a good way to dramatize that seemed to be to maybe cast it against the backdrop of a very dire situation, so that, let's say, the stakes or the needs of the addict would dwarf the stakes of the plague. You know,
yeah.
So I was constantly looking for ways of juxtaposing things. For Lucy, I wanted, you know, one of the hard things it seems to me about being a drug addict is financing it,
yeah.
And having to lie to all of your friends and family about it. I didn't want her to have those problems. I didn't want to write a book about someone who had to do that. So I made her very rich. You know, that took away that problem. And I made her mother a crackhead too, because then you really, you know, that she's surrounded by co-conspirators.
Yeah.
So she didn't have that problem either, which meant I felt like I could get at something about her, about addiction in general, more cleanly if I didn't have those satellite problems to deal with.
There's also a good deal of television in this book. In fact, you have Mother saying at one point, "There's no TV. What am I supposed to do without a TV?" And I don't think there's a single chapter, I think, in which there isn't a movie or a game show or television blaring
so
on
right.
in the background.
That's right.
And this was interesting to me. I mean, one can make a suggestion about, well, is this the new fire if these characters are existing in this savagery, or whether this is their only window into the reality around them. They're more concerned with Dick Clark than they are CNN. And in fact, I think you name every network just about in this book. So I wanted to ask you about the emphasis on television here.
Well, that's actually really interesting. Well, you know, the TV is pervasive. I mean, it really is everywhere. Everywhere you go now, there's
not
a TV.
In this
well,
cafe.
That's true. Thank
yeah.
God. That's why I like it here. But it is true. I mean, you know, wherever you go, you see these TVs. And it seems to me that TV is one of the great news vectors. You know, it's how people find out what's happening with the world. And it's a great objective correlative, because it usually it's going to tell you something about the way other people are feeling. And that's why I did that little bit on how the three networks were dealing with the plague, because
yeah.
each one of them is going to try and dictate what kind of response we need to be having to the plague, downplaying it, playing it up, you know, whatnot. And also there's a certain degree of social criticism there that, you know, isn't this revolting that these people are constantly getting their information from the news and from the TV. The TVs are always on. This is our medium of choice. This is our cultural medium of choice. I hate television.
Yeah, but the internet is a mute medium throughout this, which I found an interesting choice on your part. So, I mean, if a super plague went down, I would absolutely think that there'd be a whole bunch of conspiracy sites that would rise up. There'd be YouTube footage. I mean, well, this is now what we see with
right.
like the latest George Romero movie. But the point I'm trying to suggest here is why did you remove internet from the picture? I suppose one could say that, well, this isn't intended as a media satire, it's about a number of things, and essentially it's an interior monologue based in as external events are happening around, and therefore, or, you know, it could just be a case of, I'm now starting to answer your question, I'm going to shut up and let you actually offer an answer.
There's a little bit of internet in the book, now and then, there's a couple mentions, but you're right, it is by and large downplayed. In part because I just didn't see the characters in the book being the type of people who would flock to the internet as their source of information. They just aren't in that community. Wow.
Yeah, I've got a hell of a job putting posts.
I'm really
yeah.
sorry.
Yeah, that's all right. It's all right.
This normally never happens.
Yeah.
But so you know, like the mom, for instance, the grandmother, they're not those people that are going to do that. And Lucy, she's just not that person. So that was part of it. Again, I was just trying to come up with, it seemed credible to me that's not what they would do. It just seemed not so interesting to me. I mean, I live on the internet. I'm online all day long. I'm just not interested
so
much.
It.
So there was a kind of nostalgia there for me, too, because TV used to be the, you know, where I went.
Yeah.
But really not anymore at all.
Well, I'm wondering if it was a matter of keeping these characters doped on sex, religion, and TV, like the, you know, John Lennon song. But I wanted to actually bring up religion in this because there's a number of references to it. Late in the book, Lucy speaks to God. He doesn't answer. And this is as she is relatively clear-headed. Now, when she throws a party, she's high on crack, and She then starts rattling off tales of Nordic gods and the like. And then there's also a moment where one of Mother's friends named JC shows up, which made me think, of course, of Lou Reed and Jesus' son. But it was interesting because she can only have a closer relation to religion when she is doped up in some sense, and yet when she is clear-headed, God or religion is just not there. So the insinuation here is that, well, religion is just as ineffectual as a 12-step program. I mean, is this novel intended as a kind of polemic to some degree on individual choice, or a sort of statement of other things, including one's ability to deal with or get through one's particular turmoil?
I think that Lucy and her mom have a very different rapport with God and with their concept of God. The mother is well. You want some water?
I'm all right.
The mother is well. She's way past ever being able to find her way to religion and to whatever solace, you know, belief in God might offer her. Lucy, on the other hand, is really on a quest. She really wants to develop a kind of conscious understanding of God or something, just something outside of herself that she can turn to. That's for her. That's certainly a big part of what recovery is supposed to be about. So she's trying. I mean, even just the process of her trying is progress,
yeah,
for her. I mean, it is certainly a polemic. It's a big part of the book, certainly how various orthodoxies will co-opt disease as a kind of avenger and deterrent, for instance. You know, if you look, you know, if you continue to abide the Jews in our community, you know, the plague will strike you down.
Yeah.
Or, you know, look, you have continued to sustain the Jewish community and now we have a plague. You know, and it's not just the religious orthodoxy, it's any kind of orthodoxy.
Yeah.
So I was interested in extremism, religious extremism, so that was one part of it. But another part was very just this main character's very kind of quiet and desperate search for a God. I mean, she asks, you know, she keeps asking people, why can't I believe in something more powerful than myself? Why can't I pray? Why? She really wants that. Because even if you concede that you are not at the center of the universe, you have conceded the possibility that there might be a God, or physics, or love, or whatever, at least if it's not you. And that's a big step for someone who is just completely a total narcissist. There was twofold, you know, my interest in religion was twofold, I guess.
Gotcha. I wanted to ask about Stanley, because you have the father commit suicide, and Stanley enters the equation and is looking for a surrogate mother, and Lucy assists him, but there's a strange relationship that they have. And so the theory I was going here with was that Stanley is in some sense a surrogate father figure, that the only way that Lucy can, at least early on in the book, solve her problems is by finding various human figures to fit within this great puzzle, that the family exists as this unit from which to recover from. It's a very funny idea because, as we learn, the family is quite fucked up, but I wanted to ask you about the notion of people as puzzle pieces with which to find a coping mechanism through.
I think that's a very shrewd reading. I think that's right. Stanley is certainly a proxy figure for her. He stands in for, you know, this dad who hanged himself or hung himself. I'm not entirely sure which is the right word there.
Yeah.
But she did find him, you know, hanging from the ceiling fan with a noose around his neck, and that's kind of a tough thing to take.
Yeah.
So he does stand in that way. He's considerably older than she is, and he loves her unconditionally, which is really kind of a beautiful thing. I hope it is in the book. It certainly is in the real world. And also, one thing she learns about Stanley is that he loves her, and she loves this other guy, and that's fine. You know, that's okay. It's a relay, and the relay of love from one person to the next and from generation to generation and from reincarnated soul to reincarnated soul, it's all part of the same idea.
Yeah.
Which is this idea of recycling, that we recycle, we return, we pass it on, we share. And so that's what Stanley's doing there. You know, the father dies and comes back in Stanley, and maybe not literally in the way that all the other reincarnated souls do, but certainly emotionally for Lucy, that's exactly how it works.
But he's also something of a measuring stick with which Lucy interacts with other people. And this, of course, we all know that the common tape measure is a Stanley. And I couldn't resist. I would read this and I would immediately think of him turning into this boxy metal. Anyway.
You are attributing to me so much more intelligence than I have. I mean, I would love to think that every choice I made, I had a kind of, like I said, that I had this really smart pedigree for every choice I made. Some things were by accident.
Yeah.
You know, I. But you're right. I mean, he is a barometer, for sure. He's a measure of how well or poorly she's doing and how she interacts with other people. You know, I didn't call him Stanley for that reason, but, you know, sometimes things work out in your favor.
Yeah, yeah. You called him after Mr. Roper.
Right.
No, but I mean, this notion of walking in intuition versus planning things. I mean, when you were rewriting, was there any tracking that you did of particular motifs? I mean, how much did you leave towards reader interpretation while you are likewise remaining completely in the dark about your intent or your meaning? And how much is intended as more of this kind of game, the, going back to the sartorial elliptical thing
right.
I brought up earlier?
No, I was not in the dark about my intentions. I knew exactly what they were. You know, this novel was going to have these three themes, reincarnation, narcotics recovery, and plague, basically. And I all three of them seemed to map on top of each other in multiple ways. And I wanted to illustrate and examine how those three things were going to imbricate. So I knew I wanted to do that, which meant constantly lowering or raising the volume on some of those three, on each one of those themes as the book went along, making sure that the plague was always foregrounded, finding new ways to dramatize how the plague was going to infect people's lives, trying to demonstrate how principles of narcotics recovery and reincarnation were related in multiple ways. So thematically, I had those three things in mind, and I was intent on dramatizing the interplay among them. So when I went back to do the revisions, I wanted to make sure that I had done those things. I also obviously wanted to tell a story. I wanted it to be a kind of redemptive story. I wanted it to end up on a, well, ambiguously happy note. It depends if you think everyone's going to die or not. That's kind of up to you. Now, there's an open-ended moment in the book.
Yeah.
I wasn't able to exert control over every detail, you know, and I wasn't, you know, how those details deploy or fire, you know, in your mind or any reader's mind, you know, there's a limit to how much I could do there.
Well, there's also a limit to the spontaneity that you can offer, too, as a writer,
yeah.
Because if you control everything, then, well, how is it fun?
Right. So, I mean, those are the three things I really wanted to do. Then there were a lot of... you know, digressive points I wanted to make throughout. There's a lot of satire, there's a lot of political ire, there's a lot of clearly liberal, what's the word I'm looking for?
Agitprop?
Yes, there's agitprop. There's a kind of haranguing of the our conservative government. It seems overt to me, but, you know, so there was all of those things. You know, there's a lot of social commentary. And there's a lot of big claims about just people in general. How do we react in times of crises? You know, how are we going to be selfish or not? Are we going to help other people or not? What are the rules? You know, what is the next right thing to do under these circumstances? There are some very fundamental questions that I wanted to pose and try to address. But you're quite right. I mean, there are certain things in there that I just was not able to rein in.
Yeah.
Or control, and they spun out.
You sound somewhat disappointed, but this is a delight. Anarchy is good, particularly if you're throwing agitprop in there.
What's so funny, though, is that I did really have these very strict ideas. You know, I wanted to, you know, dramatize X, Y, and Z. But instead, what happened was I did end up with this somewhat anarchic novel. And people, you know, have said that they, you know, that it's really big on plot, and there's a lot of crazy things happening, and to me, it all seems quite organized, but no one else seems to think so. So there's a certain irony there for me that I kind of am delighted by.
Well, that's only because the text is essentially the prison between the author and the reader, and what seems completely obvious to you may not be so much obvious to a reader. But that's what makes literature fun.
I agree. And I had so much fun writing the book, and I certainly wanted people to have fun reading it, and that's a big part of it.
Well, Fiona, thanks very much for taking the time out. It's a pleasure to chat with you.
Thank you so much.
Sure.
Today will be the saddest day.